Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport. Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy. It is Wednesday and fall ball is over, but that doesn't mean that we don't get to talk about college lacrosse because I have Christian Sweezy on the line. No better font of knowledge for the world of Division I men's lacrosse, literally in the world. So, Christian, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, man.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Terry, and I appreciate that very kind introduction.
Well, I mean it in all sincerity. And I want to start by talking about your visit or attendance at the Bob Kemp Classic in October, in which you watched Denver take on Limestone. And I want to talk about that because we haven't spoken about the Pioneers very much on this podcast. And I think that they have an interesting 2018 in store for them. So start with the bare bones, very general question. What did you make of Coach Bill Tierney's squad at that event?
They had, of their top nine that they think they'll have this year, they were missing three, you know, nothing untoward. I think there were injuries. So it's Ethan Walker and a couple of the midfielders. Ethan Walker, who was leading scorer last year, and a couple of midfielders didn't travel. They stayed back in Denver. And even without three of their top nine on offense against the Division II, you know, defending national champion, Denver took 58 shots and scored 25 goals. You know, Trevor Baptiste, I had him winning, I think, 19 of 22 or 19 of 23 faceoffs. And it was actually, it was pretty impressive in the first quarter. Limestone's goalie made at least 9 or 10 saves, you know, really good saves. And then Denver finally starts to figure it out a little bit. But I was just so impressed at Denver, the ball movement, the shooting. You know, they just do a little bit of everything. And, of course, they win so many possessions with Baptiste. You know, it's a little bit of a broken record. People who question the defense or question the goalie, and I'm not necessarily doing that here. But it's almost like it doesn't matter because, you know, it's make it take it when you have Trevor Baptiste. And Sean Mayle, the long stick middie, who was hurt for part of last year, looked very good against Limestone, did not have a knee brace on, you know, was a really good on the wings on faceoffs. And so I was very impressed, you know, top to bottom. I thought they looked very, very good. I thought they looked very hungry too. And talking to Bill Tierney and Matt Brown after the game, that was one of the things they said about their take on it. So yeah, you know, these guys played pretty well. They played pretty hard, you know, and they did look like they had a little bit of an edge to them. So I was very impressed.
I just want your reaction to this idea. So Denver wins the national championship in 2015. You know, they felt like they were running into form and on track for a repeat performance in 2016, and then they get upset in the Big East Championship to Marquette, losing the first round to Towson. And now heading into 2017, Connor Canizzaro feels like a Twarton guy. You know, Tyler Pace, lingering injury issues, etc. You know, lose a couple of high-profile games. North Carolina, that 16-7 game on Sunday on ESPNU at Ohio State, I think, left a relatively bad taste in folks' mouths. One of the things that's always going to be true for Denver is that, you know, their Big East schedule is going to include a lot of television appearances, but not a lot of top 10, top 15 opponents. And as a result, kind of feels like by mid-March, from mid-March through mid-April, they disappear off the national radar a little bit. And then rounded into form, this team, which finished the year 13-4 and I believe was 11-3 heading into the NCAA tournament, loses to the eventual national champion in the NCAA semifinals by a goal on, you know, a couple of controversial in or out of the crease calls. The point I'm getting at is, and this very well may be a me thing, but I want to see if you share it. It doesn't feel like their 2017 season is as highly regarded as it should be based on all that they accomplished, and it's coloring my expectations for them in 2018, which is basically like, this is a team that can win a national championship, but I don't necessarily count them among that group when I think about the roster composition, what they're bringing to the table. It feels almost as if it's Trevor Baptiste, and he's such a game decider. But beyond that, I have a hard time getting excited about what they have, except I know that when I see it in person, I'm going to be like, oh, yeah, they've got a lot. So I'm just curious to what your reaction is to that idea.
I actually agree with you. It's funny because they don't seem particularly athletic to me. You know, They've seen, you know, the attackmen last year, 5'9", 5'10", 5'8", you know, and they're quick and they're super skilled. I'm not saying you can't be good if you're 5'8", obviously. I'm not saying that at all. But it seemed like they were three very rather similar players on attack. And I think they've tried to switch that up a little bit. You know, I think they have a few, you know, middies like attackmen bumping up a little bit. A couple of the freshmen whom they really, really like actually were injured. One had a foot injury, and so we didn't get to see them. You know, I do get the impression that they are a little bit more athletic on offense than maybe they have been. I think their defense always has been athletic. Certainly Sean Mayle and some of the guys from last year, I think they've been athletic on that side of the field. But, you know, there's such a precise ball movement. You know, and it's funny talking to the coaches for Faceoff Yearbook interviews. And one of the things Bill Tierney said is that, you know, we really rely on our middies to be good feeders and to have good vision. Because I ask each coach, who's your best feeder? Who's your best inside shooter? Things like that. And that was really interesting to me. You know, I never really, you know, to me, passing is kind of a lost art. And passing from the midfield is even more of a lost art. And yet Denver tries to bring it back. So maybe, probably they're more athletic than I'm giving them credit for. They just don't blow me away with athleticism because they're so super skilled. Maybe they make it look easy.
Well, and they also don't really try to run past defenses. You know, they try to throw through them and throw around them.
Exactly. And I think your point about the Big East is well taken too. You know, that league has taken a little bit of a dip. I think Villanova will be better this year. I know we'll talk about them in a minute. Providence is certainly building something. And Marquette, you know, what can you say? Each time they get counted out, they make the NCAA tournament and win that conference tournament. So, you know, I'm very intrigued by Denver. I have to admit, like you, I never put them in my list of three or four teams who can win the whole thing. And then someone who knows much more about the sport than I do will bring them up. And I'll say, yeah, you know what? I probably should have mentioned Denver this time as well. And certainly with Coach Tierney's track record and Matt Brown's track record, you'd be foolish to count them out of anything.
You mentioned Ethan Walker and a couple of the other guys that were injured, and that's not a new phenomenon for a team that, you know, is so reliant on Canadian offensive players and brings in guys that spend their summer playing box lacrosse. Injuries in the fall are just a normal course of things. Aside from Trevor Baptiste and to a lesser degree Ethan Walker, who do you think is a linchpin player that needs to have a good season in 2018 in order for this team to be successful?
Some of their big, hard-dodging middies, you know, Joe Reed, you know, Murano, some of these guys who are going to have a little bit of size to them, a little bit of sizzle to them. Colt McCaffrey is a senior attackman who he's very thick. You know, Jeremy Bosher, same. They're very thick, great shooters, incredible shooters, you know, and very creative. You know, sometimes it's tight arms, sometimes it's overhands. You know, they don't do the same thing twice. And so, Walker obviously is a phenomenal player, you know, and I think they have some very talented attackmen down there. But I think some of the guys who have a little bit of, you know, pretty decent athleticism, or the McCaffrey, Bosher, who are just big physical guys, I think will be very hard matchups for defenses. So, I think the secondary guys might even be a little bit better than they have been the last couple of years.
Is it important to talk about their defense, or are they just never going to have to play defense because they have arguably the best faceoff guy to ever play the game?
Well, you know, Bill likes their defense, I have to admit. I mean, maybe he has to say that, but you know, he gets a little prickly when people pick on the Denver defense. And, you know, they made the Final Four last year, as you said, without even getting out of second gear. So I do think they have some talent there. Obviously, they have some talent there. I think they're better on defense than people realize. Do we have to talk about it? It's unbelievable. It's one of the things I love about our sport. It's such a huge X factor. And I guess, you know, if you don't have the face-off guy, you probably hate it about our sport. But yeah, I think their defense will be fine. And as I said, Sean Mayle is an eyeful. He's a terrific long stick middie.
Well, Christian, you mentioned what life is like without a face-off guy. And there's really only one way to find him, is to recruit him. And what better way to do that than ZipRecruiter? Unfortunately, I'm not sure that face-off guys are a position that's available on there, but certainly should be. If you're in need of great talent for your business but short on time, you don't have to get lost in a huge stack of resumes to find your perfect hire. You just need the right tools, smarter tools. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. You can rest easy knowing your job is being seen by the right candidates. ZipRecruiter then puts its smart matching technology to work,
actively notifying qualified candidates about your job within minutes of your posting, so you receive the best possible matches. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates to find you. It finds them. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. The easy ZipRecruiter dashboard lets you manage your hiring process from start to finish, all in one place. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by the growing businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. Right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/lacrosse. That's ZipRecruiter.com/lacrosse. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/lacrosse. Once again, as always, we appreciate you for checking out our sponsors. You love seeing lacrosse in all of these reads. We appreciate you checking out ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter.com/lacrosse.
All right. Well, on that note, the other fall event that you hit was Navy versus Villanova. We spent a lot of time talking about the midshipmen on this podcast, so I don't want to belabor the point. Mm-hmm. But certainly their 2016 season was really fascinating as they made it to the NCAA quarterfinals. Their 2017 season was fascinating as they entered the season with high expectations and were injury riddled. Their offseason has been fascinating as their recruiting has been, you know, cutting edge in many respects. What's your liner notes on the midshipmen heading into 2018?
The offense will be better. Casey Reese looked really good against Villanova. It was his first game back. You know, I've forgotten this, that Casey Reese, who's the midfielder for Navy, tore his knee, missed all of last season. I've forgotten that his last time we saw Casey Reese playing lacrosse, it was his sophomore year, and he scored 4 goals against Yale in the NCAA tournament and then scored 5 against Brown the next week in an NCAA quarterfinal. Like, he's sort of always been an athlete whose lacrosse skills were kind of catching up to his athleticism. And I felt like that, you know, that 2 week span there, or 1 week span, I guess, in the NCAA tournament in 2016 was when he started to, like, oh, this is the guy Navy has for the next 2 years, and he's going to be unbelievable. So, you know, he really, you know, in our sport, there's so few secrets. And I do feel like Reese is still a little bit of an unknown in that, I mean, how good can he actually be? You know, 34 goals, and he's technically still learning the game. You know, Grayson Terrain, another midfielder, an incredible athlete, just does everything, offense, defense, face-off wings. Very similar. You know, he does things on the lacrosse field that are very hard to defend. So when you look at those things, and Jack Ray, I think, is the linchpin for them. Jack Ray last year, 6 goals in a scrimmage against North Carolina, hurt his foot the second game of the year, wound up with only 5 goals for the whole season. You know, if he's healthy, if he's feels confident on that foot, and I have to admit, when I saw him against Villanova, he looked rather tentative. He didn't score. Villanova did a nice job on him defensively as well. Zach Kreisa, one of their big sophomore defensemen, 6'5", like 230 or something, did a really nice job keeping Ray quiet, and Ray did look tentative as well. But, you know, this is another team. We were talking about Denver, and their midfielders have to feed. You know, Navy might be a team that's really midfield-driven. I was curious that they moved Ryan Wade, the second-leading scorer last year, and the leading assist guy by 10 assists, from attack to midfield, because they think he'll get a short stick if he's the third guy in the midfield with Terrain and Reese. You know, so Navy, I think, is really going all in on that midfield, which is rare. And I think it's interesting, and I'm excited to see how that works out, because, you know, I sort of like middies myself.
Well, and they've got a couple of senior goal scorers in David Little and Chris Hill that probably could be able to hold things down at the attack. I mean, that's the thing about this offense is that, well, let me put this into context. I was talking to a Towson alum heading into this year's Final Four, when the Tigers have been so impressive coming off of a quarterfinal season in 2016 by virtue of the fact that they had graduated and replaced so many of their defensive players. And I asked, all right, well, they're basically going to have to do the same thing at the offensive end of the field between 17 and 18. Do you think the same level of replication is possible? And he said, no, the reason being that defense is so systemic and so systematized that it's easier to plug in new players and have them learn how to execute and perform at the level that's necessary to make it to the quarterfinals of the Final Four or whatever. Whereas offense, requires a lot more skill and savvy and the types of things that need to be developed with time and experience or need to be replaced by, you know, a higher threshold of player. And are you fortunate enough to have that within your program? When I look at Navy's returning contributors, I see a lot of guys at the offensive end of the field that are coming back. Really only Colin Feilmacher needs to be replaced. Their graduation losses come much more substantially at the other end of the field. You know, I guess if you count Brady Dove as the guy that prevents them from having to play defense, and then certainly Matt Reese and Chris Fennell, two long poles who in that 2016 season made a lot of hay. You know, I think that there is reasons for optimism. You mentioned Casey Reese, and the thing that comes to mind when I think of him is that overtime game-winning goal against Army
that was amazing.
Yeah, and so for me, that was what planted the seed that led to that 9-goal, 2-game stretch that you referenced in the NCAA tournament. You know, it was like the confidence or 7 goals. The confidence born out of that is what... The confidence born out of that rivalry overtime game winner is what led to those breakout performances. And the question that obviously remains, and this remains for a lot of guys, there are so many guys that missed last season due to injury that you have to question as they return, how much of your limitations and rust are going to be shaken off and what's going to be your rate of recovery, your rate of return. You know, and you mentioned having seen Reese against Villanova being very impressed. And I think that that's an important point of evidence, but let's talk about Villanova and let's talk about life without the Ficaros, because you know that is a different life for the Wildcats. What is your take on Coach Mike Garrado's squad?
You know, and to go back for just a second, I agree so much with what you just said about defense, and in particular, and don't forget, defense has a little goalie who can, you know, you can make the worst mistake in the world on defense and your goalie makes a save and no one has any idea you made a mistake. So I do take your point, I think, about defense and systemic and having a goalie back there too to help. Villanova, the one thing that impressed me, and I didn't really catch it, they won the scrimmage 13-6. It was 9-5 after 3 quarters, Villanova. The thing that impressed me, and I have to admit, I didn't realize it until I started writing the Face Off Yearbook capsule for them. It seemed like every time I mentioned someone who's senior, fifth-year senior, sixth-year senior, you know, they have so much experience in that offense. And that's a good thing because their offense, they're constant motion. You know, they call their own plays. They call their own sets. You know, I think Simon Connor, the offensive coordinator, has some input in that stuff. But once they get on the field, I think the guys have a lot of autonomy to run what they think will work. So these are, you know, I mean, there really is. I think it was 4 seniors in a sophomore and a freshman in their top 6 on offense. And for a team like that, that's a really big deal. You know, I think they might be a little bit under the radar for this season. I was very impressed by Villanova. I was very impressed. They have a nice mix of shooters, feeders, dodgers. You know, this Connor Kirst, the sophomore who played D midfield last year, is playing offensive midfield now. He's like 6'3", 215. He looks almost like a John Reese type player out there, if you remember him from the late 80s, early 90s. Just a big, physical, great shooter. You know, can stay on the field and play defense if you need him to, can take faceoffs if you need him to. I think they have a lot more. And Matt Farid in goal, I think, you know, really helps. You know, he's, what, 2 years removed from being a second-team All-American. So, and granted, it was not a great year for goalies that year, but second-team All-American is second-team All-American. And I think in the past, goalie has been a little bit of an issue for them when they don't, you know, Villanova has been good in a lot of other areas, but, you know, they've never been great on faceoffs and they've never been great in goal. They've been solid. But, you know, this team that might actually be pretty darn good on faceoffs, it might be pretty darn good in goal. And if you give that offense repeated possessions or if Barrett can make some saves and they can get out and run a little bit, you know, this is a much more dangerous team, I think, than I, even having seen them, once I sat down to write the capsule, I realized how much experience and knowledge they have back. You know, it's a nice team.
A couple of things. These are news items, I suppose, and I'm not sure to what degree they're already out, and I'm not sure to what degree you know, this was a part of your conversation with Coach Garrado. Joey Ficarro, what do we know about his status for 2018?
I believe he'll be back. We didn't talk about it, but I believe he was on the sideline with the team in 2017. I mean, on Saturday when I saw them. I don't think he'll be back this year, but I do think he'll be back next year.
Got it. And then the arrival of Matt Donovan, the former Georgetown attackman who just showed up and wants to play defensive midfield.
Yeah, he is on the roster now. I remember him from Georgetown. He was the fastest what probably the fastest player on the team. And you know, I think he really, you know, again, you're only as good as your short 60 middies. And I think he has a chance to really help Villanova.
It's a fascinating, fascinating turn of events, particularly for a team, you know, that's been impacted by transfers in a very meaningful way. You know, I think sometimes...
Yeah, and I think it's actually Chris Donovan. I think Matt was the brother from...
you're right. I'm sorry. Thank you for that correction. But you know, you think about it, and it's kind of... It's hard, I think, to really keep your mind in the place of who did you lose and who did you gain, right? And so, you know, certainly... In Jake Furcaro and to a lesser degree Joey Furcaro, because he was a Swiss commitment as opposed to a transfer. You already mentioned Matt Barrett, you know, and then for a team that lost a midfielder to Duke, who you know was a you know substantial contributor, to pick up, I guess you know for lack of a better word, a very surprising transfer. In a former Georgetown attackman who wants to play Dimitri is a really interesting story heading into the 2018 season.
And I do think he has the speed to be really good at that position, match feet, you know, one man clear, punt return type. I'm very, very curious to see how he does.
Well, so you mentioned a couple times throughout this conversation that a huge percentage of your perspective has been informed by having conversations with 80% of our Face Off Yearbook top 25 coaches. Heading into next season, I want to ask again, just start with a very generic and general one. Well, actually, you know what? Before I get to that, I want to ask my favorite question. How many coaches have said we're going to play faster this year?
Oh, I thought your favorite question was paper or plastic. That's my favorite. You know, not as many as last year. I think they must have read that column where you called them out. And so Ohio State said it, but I think that they – we're looking at more once the shot clock comes in. I think, you know, they're trying. So they played with a shot clock all fall. They played with a shot clock. I think you were at the thumbs up game against North Carolina, and they played with a shot clock in their scrimmage against one of the MLL teams. So he's, you know, Nick Myers wants to play faster. I didn't hear it a ton from other coaches, though.
Good, because it's so disingenuous, and it's kind of like I think about it in that Mike Tyson, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face, which is
get punched in the face.
Everybody wants to play fast until your opponent plays slow, and then you're just going to do what you need to do in order to hold on to the ball. Everybody wants to play fast until they start losing faceoffs. Everybody wants to play fast until their opposing goalie starts making saves.
No, I agree.
Before
we
move on from this topic, and the topic is pace of play, not platitudes or coach speak. What is your overall reaction to the experimental rules? Do you feel like it was meaningful?
I do. Now, Navy and Villanova did not use the shot clock, which I thought was interesting. And they just said, well, we're not going to play with it this season. We shouldn't, you know, there's no need to do it. And I see the logic entirely. Denver and Limestone the next day did use the shot clock. And I think I put their stats out, you know, they were, The shot numbers were not as wide a discrepancy as I thought, but the goals were, you know, Denver Limestone finished 25-11, you know, Villanova Navy was 13-6. Someone called me out on Twitter, Jack Coyne, who's great, and he said, well, if it's not the same teams playing, you know, shot clock versus non-shot clock, it's probably not that great a comparison, but I provide it just because I thought it was. But, you know, and even talking to Nick Myers and talking about, well, you know, we're going to probably have to play a little bit faster once the shot clock comes in. And I do think it might negate some of the face-off and dominance and, you know, if it turns into a higher possession game, and maybe I'm naive for thinking it automatically will. But if it does that, I think it's good. And again, from what I saw firsthand, the game with the shot clock looked a lot crisper and sharper than the game without, which is not to bemoan the game without. And to be fair, I was against the shot clock for a long time, so I'm still in the wait and see how it turns out mode. But I was very impressed by what I saw with the shot clock in that Denver Limestone scrimmage.
On Monday on InsideTheCross.com, Patrick McEwen wrote an exhaustive essay about, well, that acted on the premise and a precept, which I think, based on the IMLCA and NCAA's issuance of these experimental rules, has more merit than not, which is the shot clock is a when, not if situation. And I think, like you, a lot of the landscape is still in a wait and see type of mode. And the question is, if there is going to be a shot clock, what are the mechanisms? Patrick is very, very firmly in favor of it must start on possession of the ball for the defensive team. and it should be 90 seconds long. And if this includes the question of whether or not there should be a two-point line, he comes down on the side of no. Let's set aside that two-point question for now. Do you have a strong opinion on when the shot clock should begin and how long it should last?
No. And the people with whom I watched the Denver Limestone scrimmage, a couple former coaches and former players, I think they were sort of hopeful that it would start as soon as the offensive team gets in the box. You know, I didn't ask them the preference. I think that was just one option they sort of threw out there. I haven't really thought about it enough to have formed an educated opinion one way or the other. But that is what I overheard and heard, people tell me when I asked them what they thought. They would like 1 minute once the offense touches into the offensive box.
Excellent.
All right. 45 seconds or whatever it might be.
Sure. Moving on. Back to what I was originally referencing, general question. What's your biggest takeaway from your conversations so far? You know, like I said, you've spoken to 20 of the top 25 coaches. Any surprises, anything that's really stuck with you from those first 20 conversations?
I'm surprised that, Richmond, a lot of the teams, Richmond, Marquette, BU, that were sort of, they're all in that same cycle. You know, you get the 4 years and you have a big senior class, and now you're sort of kind of starting over, but not really, because you've had some success and you've been able to recruit some pretty good players. But it is funny to hear those three teams sort of cycle, be in that same cycle. And not that that's good or bad, but it's sort of interesting. One of the things that surprised me is how, and I should have done this ahead of time, but it's funny, 10 years ago, writing for Face Off Yearbook, it was the same coaches over and over again. And now, referencing BU, Marquette, Richmond, schools like that, it's funny how many, Providence, I talked to Coach Gabrielli for the first time this year. I mean, I've talked to him in the past, but for the first time for Face Off Yearbook, Brian Brecht was sort of joking. He said, "Oh, Christian's calling us. We must be ranked pretty high." I hadn't talked to him in a while for Face Off Yearbook. So I really like talking to the different coaches. It makes the write-ups a little harder because I don't see these teams as regularly as others, but I think that's good. I think it's, I don't want to use the word parity, but I do think it's fun to have so many different teams in that top 20, top 25 from even five years ago.
Do you, with respect to your point about new programs that have finished their fourth, fifth, or sixth varsity season and are trying to parlay into or transition into phase two of the program's existence, coming off of those conversations, are you more bullish or bearish than you would have been prior to the conversation about whether or not they're going to be able to meet the expectation of success in 2018?
I'm bullish on BU. They seem to have some athletes. Ryan Pauley, I think, was very in-depth on his team, which I appreciated. Strengths, weaknesses, the whole nine. I mean, it was fascinating to listen to him. And I just get the impression that they really like some of their young guys who they have. Marquette, I think, has some injuries. And I think they're probably a little bit up in the air on some of the injuries. And Richmond, I think, is just so new on their defense. I think you and I were saying last year, talking about their great goalie, and Brendan Hines, a great defenseman. I think they only gave up 6.25 goals a game last year. Like, that's a huge... And yes, we've said defense is more, sort of a system. But I think they have a lot to replace at Richmond. And just I get the sense that BU, maybe some of their injuries last year, some of the guys that they thought would be playing for the first time this year wound up playing for the first time last year. BU was the one of the three. And again, I have huge respect for all three programs and what they do and what they accomplish and where they're headed in particular. And I think Dan Chiamatti might be the best young coach in the sport. But if you're asking me which of the three jumps out at me, it's BU.
The thing about BU that has impressed me, and this was less true in 2017 as it was in 14, 15, and 16, but the way they continued to, there's a word for this and it's not coming to mind right now, but basically in 14, their leading scorers were freshmen. And you would have expected those guys to be their leading scorers in 15 as sophomores. But no, there were two new guys that arrived and they were the new leading scorers as freshmen. And then it happened again, And so when you look back last year, their roster was much more rounded with respect to the grade distribution of the contributors. And they were led by Cal Dearth, who played all over the field and was probably like a little bit of a Superman for them. And so replacing him is certainly going to be a challenge. That being said, you know, in Jack Wilson and Ryan Hilburn and James Burr and John McClain and Hayden Ruiz and Brennan Holmeyer, you know, they've got these guys that throughout their career have been in really substantial roles. And so to your point, in terms of the offensive distribution of burden, you know, there are a lot of shoulders they can lean on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't remember the freshman off the top of my head, but he mentioned a couple of freshmen they really like. Pretty athletic kids, and I think they got some pretty decent recruits in there. So no, they, you know, I don't mean to throw a bunch of pressure on them, but I remember coming away from that interview and thinking, oh, I can't wait to see BU play in the spring.
I would assume he was referring to Chris Gray, an Under Armour All-American out of Shoreham Wing River, who is
one of the names that came up. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, he's an interesting player to me in the sense that, you know, he's a lefty, and you know, when I watch him and when I read about him and think about him and talk to some other folks about him, you know, kind of made it seem like, yeah, he's a finisher, he's a goal scorer. And then, you know, talk to some folks around that team, and it's like, no, I think he's going to be carrying the ball a lot. You know, I don't want to make this comparison, it's a little early, but that perception, my mind went through the same evolution with a guy named Connor Fields as what I just described. So, just, you know, file that one away.
Interesting. Thank you. I will do.
The second side of the conversation, I guess, is as you consider not necessarily like the overall impressions or surprises, but more so we set these expectations and try to organize the creation of the Face-Off Yearbook before fall ball begins. And so we set these rankings, and then you have conversations, and whether it's injuries or performances or whatever, sometimes the tone, the subtext of how good you think the team is going to be, it suggests maybe they should have been ranked higher. So far, is there a team that, you know, say is ranked in the teens that you think is going to be a top 10 team based on your conversation with the coach?
I know a lot of people, and I got this a little bit from talking to Joe Alberici, but a lot of people think Army is a little underrated. I think we have them in that late teens, early 20s. You know, some a couple of people whose opinion I really trust saw them up in Baltimore at that tournament at Boys Latin, and
yep,
came back and said, oh, the defense is impressive. Offense is pretty athletic, a couple pretty good skill guys, very deep roster.
Giants.
Very good goalie.
There are a lot of 6'3", 6'4", 6'5", yeah, midfielders, exactly. Tackmen.
Exactly. You know, and that David Sims is an eyeful, and Teddy Glessner is an eyeful. So they were one team. You know, I always get inspired talking to Nick Myers. I just always enjoy those conversations. And, you know, he's so just listening to him, I just want to run through a brick wall. Like, I can't imagine what it would be like to play for him, because – you know, I think Ohio State, he has me convinced they're going to be really darn good again, regardless they lost a lot. You know, and certainly Trey LeClaire is just an incredible player, an incredible shooter, and can do so many different things for that offense. So I think they'll be pretty good, although I think we have them, you know, they're not in the teens. I think they're probably in like that 10, 11, 12 range. I'm trying to think who else, but those were the two. Of course, a minute to hang up, I'll come up with 10 others. But those were the two that I remember thinking, like, and BU, to be fair, although we've already talked about them. But those are the three that I remember filing away thinking, oh, I'm really excited to see these three teams.
In the same way that I think I wanted to talk about Denver because we haven't spoken about them a ton on the podcast, et cetera. You know, this isn't necessarily true for these three teams, but I want to ask you specifically about, you know, three of the most prominent programs in the sport. And I'm just going to go by, you know, where they're tentatively ranked right now. Number 9 in Face-Off Yearbook, Syracuse. Didn't practice in the fall, at least, nope, you know, extensively. They had their fall season cut short. What is your baseline expectation for Syracuse right now?
Their fall season is almost like an Ivy League fall season because it was so truncated. I think the Ivy League has allowed, 12 practices and one play date in the fall. So, you know, and that doesn't bite the Ivy League teams as much as people realize. You know, Yale has been pretty good. You know, I think they've had some – Cornell's been pretty good in the past. So I think they're, you know, for them, it was a lot of clearing, you know, because of the weather up there. I think they do have an indoor practice facility now. I think if this had happened 5 years ago, it would have had a huge impact because, you know, they don't get the whole Carrier Dome until, the middle of March for practices. So, you know, a lot of the things that they like to work on in the fall had that in mind. And I think that their new facility will will mitigate that somewhat. You know, I'm sure it hurts them a little bit. I'm sure they would have much rather had the practices than not. And Syracuse, the one thing is that they have such a big roster. I think that the not having those practices might hurt them trying to form a depth chart or trying to fit some of the new faces in and figure out who plays well with whom. You know, and those little things, they might get off to a fairly slow start. But, you know, John Desko was, you know, I think he thinks they might actually have a pretty solid team this year. So, you know, if it bites them, I think it would bite them early.
Right. You two excellent points there. I mean, I hadn't even thought about it. I've been in that new facility, and it didn't even occur to me that how significant that was going to be. I talked to a coach last week and asked, well, what is the most substantial thing you do in the fall? And they talked about riding and clearing. You wow. know, and the idea of not being able to utilize a full field in January and February, and hoping that you have a good amount of your riding and clearing in place by the time spring practice starts is really fascinating. And then the second topic or the second point you made, that deep roster means that, you know, guy number 50, guy number 60, guy number 70, whether or not you have to make a decision on if he redshirts or if you cut him, Sergio Salcedo is the blueprint for if you make the wrong decision, it could have a significant impact yeah. on your team. If not this year, then next year or the year after, and truncating fall practice and, you know, getting outside of one of the things I talk about when I talk about fall practice, is how casual the vibe is. And it gives you an opportunity to evaluate in a different way. You're not trying to prepare necessarily. You're trying to build, and losing the opportunity to do that, it'll be fascinating to see what the ramifications continue to be. But enough about the Orange. Moving on, the Johns Hopkins Blue Jays. What do you think of them?
I think they've addressed a lot of the culture issues. You know, talking to them, I think they were very dialed in, but in a different way. You know, it's sort of business casual, if you will. You know, in the past, I think the place has been very buttoned down. I think it's been a little tight at times. As much as I respect that program and how hard the coaches work at everything, game planning, recruiting, practicing, the whole nine, I do think that they sort of play tight. And I also think that for whatever reason, they have run out of steam late in the season, you know, and I think that one of the things they did this fall was try to address that. I remember Loyola addressing something similar a couple of years ago. You know, they did their scrimmage in the middle of fall and then did another 2 weeks afterwards to work on some of the things I saw in the scrimmage rather than scrimmaging and, you know, and then that's it for another 4 months. And I think Hopkins adopted that. I think a little bit, you know, I think that they started a little bit later. I think they tweaked a few things. They're playing much more indoor lacrosse, which I thought was interesting because they want to get better on ground balls and everyone with a short stick and tight confined spaces. That's not a bad way to learn how to get better on ground balls. So I think that they are definitely taking the right steps to making sure that this season doesn't kind of flame out the way that previous seasons have for them late going. I think they have a lot of talent. And for me, Joel Tinney is just, you know, he's the engine. I mean, he's everything. I love watching his competitive nature. The story I tell is when he was a freshman, I wound up watching a little bit of the Virginia Johns Hopkins game when Joel was a freshman at Homewood Field on the field level. And there was a face-off late in the game. It's a one goal game. And Joel Tinney is looking at the ref to see he's a wing. And he's looking at the ref to see when the ref is going to blow the whistle. Everyone else is looking at the center of the field. Joel's looking at the ref. You know, just little things like that. And I remember his sophomore year when he was suspended for the year, didn't play, and Hopkins lost to Maryland at home. It was, you know, a big crowd. And Maryland, that was the Maryland team, was very good. Wound up going to the title game and losing to North Carolina. And a couple of the Maryland guys who knew Tinney, they were sort of joking with him in the handshake line afterward. And he just said, nope. You know, put his hand up, said, no, not now. Like, he took it so personally. He didn't even play. And he took it so personally how Hopkins had lost. So I do think that he is going to have a pretty big year. And I think he's sort of that special personality as much as a player. You know, there's a lot of talented players out there, but not everyone has that personality. Not everyone has that competitive fire that I see out of him. And, you know, he's another one. If we're talking about people we're excited to see in the spring, like, I cannot wait to watch Joel Tinney. I call him the franchise. Like, I cannot wait to see the franchise because I think he can lift them to a whole different level. And I'm pleased for them that they are sort of addressing some of the things that they thought cost them late in the season the past few years, because some of those playoff games have been hard to watch.
And then the last one, the University of Virginia Cavaliers.
You know, it was funny talking to Lars because he's just sort of a straight shooter. You know, as good as Virginia is and as improving as Virginia is in a lot of other areas, I still don't know what they have on faceoffs, and I don't think they know what they have on faceoffs either. So that,
you know, I want to push back on that. I want to push back on that a little bit. So when you look at a team that finishes the year, or and I will pull up their stats as we're having this conversation because I'm not sure exactly where they finished the year, but I do know that at points during the year when they were blaming faceoff and goaltending for their problems, they were facing off at like nearly 60%, maybe even better than 60%, and saving the ball at like a 52% clip. And my reaction was, Duke has won national championships with numbers that aren't that good. Like, and not only that, but yes, realizing that Jason Murphy is gone, Luke Brugel was part of that tandem that was facing off at better than 60%. And, you know, Justin Schwenk might be able to contribute substantially there. I understand that Will Gural is not walking through that door. And there's got, a team cannot rely on winning 65 to 70% of their faceoffs in order to win games.
No, and it was interesting talking to Lars. One of the things he said over and over, he said, we still want to play fast, but we have to be better in half field sets. We have to be better 6-on-6 offense. We have to be better 6-on-6 defense. I think they recognize that at some point it's a little naive. You know what? I'm trying to remember when Manchester United were playing in the Champions League, you know, years ago, and it was this all-out attack, and, you know, and they wound up losing 3-2, and there was this epic game, and the opposing manager said, yeah, it was sort of tactical chaos on their side. You know, like, you can't really, if you're a well-drilled team, you can see your way through tactical chaos a lot more than people realize. So I think Virginia is becoming a little bit more buttoned down. I'm excited to see them. Certainly that midfield line, you know, Conrad, Moore, Aitken, I mean, those are three really, really impressive middies, and, you know, I don't know that Lars will put all three of them together. In fact, I think he said he's trying not to. But if there's some point where those three middies are in the field at the same time, like, that's an eyeful. And certainly they like their attack. But, you know, I'm curious. I mean, I'm sure they'll be fine. They're certainly getting better. The recruiting's been fine. The freshman goalie, Rode, I saw play in high school and it's fantastic. You know, I was very impressed by him. So I think they'll be better. But the question is about Virginia. Like, you know, it's one thing to say you're going to be better, but who – you know, someone in the ACC is going to have to drop a little bit to let Virginia at the front table, and I don't see who that is. I think Duke is going to be fantastic this year. I think Carolina is going to be better than they were last year. And Notre Dame, you know, maybe they would be the one you would say are a little bit vulnerable, but I don't think Syracuse is all that vulnerable at that front table. So, you know, it's interesting how Virginia, because that landscape of that conference, you know, there's not a whole lot of room there for them to squeeze their way back into that head table, and no one's going to get up and let them do it, I can tell you that much.
And that's where you look at Virginia and you wonder whether or not – it's so funny because for a program that recruits as well as they do, they just have a relatively small number of players that they rely on. It's amazing to me, and it's a function, I think, in some respects, of having a relatively small roster as well. You know, but you don't have to get that far beyond their top four or five to start to wonder whether or not is there a guy that they trust. And certainly coming away from a season in which, you know, they graduated Zed Williams, Ryan Lukovic, and Joe French, they're going to need guys to step up in order to come anywhere near the offensive efficiency production that they put up last year. And so while I think that there's a lot of interest surrounding a midfield of Dox Aitken, Ryan Conrad, and Matt Moore, first of all, those guys need to produce more in order to set the tone than they did last year. Certainly that's true for a freshman and Matt Moore. Second of all, they still need a second midfield. And then third of all, that doesn't address the issue of who's going to replace your second leading scorers production in Zed Williams. So a lot of questions. You know, I think that to your point about the ACC power dynamic, it's never not going to be true. So,
right.
You know, the question is, like, how? And it's funny because you can make a similar comparison, right-size the conversation for the Ivy League, and make a similar comparison to Brown. You know, Brown wasn't going to be able to sit around and wait for Yale to concede the table or Cornell to concede the table or for Princeton to stop trying. You know, so it's a similar dynamic in that respect. The difference being that for Virginia, you know, there's a big zero in a win column that stretches back pretty far.
Yeah, they have not been ranked number one, I think, since 2011, haven't won an NCAA tournament game since 2012. And as you say, their struggles in the ACC conference, is it one win in 5 years?
Yeah.
It's interesting.
We'll wind this conversation down, Christian. And you are one of the best at communicating excitement and enthusiasm. Because, like, this unbridled joy is just so clearly emoted through your tone of voice. You know, we sit here on signing day, and looking ahead to the beginning of the spring season, how do you characterize your emotion? How do you characterize your excitement for the 2018 campaign?
You know, I don't think I'll ever be excited for fall ball because I love college football. And then I always get excited for fall ball. I always fall in love with the sport again. Then, you know, the holidays, Christmas, all that. But, you know, I don't even watch college basketball anymore because it's just college football ends January 8th and I'm right into lacrosse January 9th or however the days work this year. So I, you know, cold weather, I don't really care. I have an opinion, but I don't think anyone cares. So, no, I'm very excited. And as I say, there's so many good teams out there. One team, and I mentioned Brian Brecht earlier, but, you know, Rutgers, they might really be good this year. And I think that Big Ten is almost turning into the ACC a little bit in terms of that head table. Like there's, I mean, that Big Ten tournament, I mean, you're talking Penn State, Ohio State, Johns Hopkins, Maryland, and Rutgers, and Michigan to a certain extent. But those top five, I mean, imagine trying to, you know, how do you pick the four teams to make the tournament when those, you know, someone who misses the Big Ten tournament is going to be a really, really, really good lacrosse team. So, you know, I'm fascinated for the Big Ten. I'm excited by some of these new, or maybe not new, but just better out-of-conference games. You know, Navy-Syracuse will be interesting. I think Villanova-Yale is going to turn into a nice little rivalry this year. I think they play down in Dallas. There's a couple other games. I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. You know, Rutgers-Brown, I think, has a chance to be super interesting. Again, a little bit of a high-tempo track meet. You know, so just little things like that. You know, I like that the schedules are changing a little bit. You know, a couple new rivalries here and there because same old gets a little dull.
Duke Towson is one that I think is going to be fascinating.
Yeah, I forgot. Sean did mention that one. That will be an interesting game.
Yeah, there's a lot to look forward to. And Christian, you've certainly helped us whet the appetite. We're going to let you go. We know that you got a lot of work to do both in your new job. Congratulations. Do you want to tell the listeners about that?
Yeah, thank you very much. So 2.5 weeks ago, I left the Washington Post after 20 years, which is 140 dog years. And I took a job at the Eternal Word Television Network. EWTN is Catholic TV. We reach 261 million homes worldwide in 144 countries. And I am a news writer and also writing scripts, editing scripts, producing segments, fact-checking, helping on social media. And I told one of my coworkers, my favorite part of the day is that I'm the one who gets to look at Pope Francis's homily from his daily mass and figure out what parts of it we'll use for our show. So for someone who's, you know, returned to his Catholic faith a few years ago and has just been just so touched and honored by coming back to the faith, like it feels really good to be here.
Well, and, you know, I certainly know how good of a fit that is for you. So congratulations on that professional transition. And certainly, you know, we at Inside Lacrosse are very thankful and fortunate to continue to have your contributions, certainly in the fall, with this face-off yearbook effort. And then, obviously, as we transition to spring and folks have an opportunity to reach you on a weekly basis.
No, I can't wait. And thank you so much for continuing to have me. I cannot wait for the spring.
All right, Sweeze, we'll talk to you again soon.
Cool. Thank you, Terry.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.